It is 8:06. Good morning. It is Monday, May 25th. It's Memorial Day today. Currently 51 degrees with clear skies in Old Town Park City with a high of 77 this afternoon. It's 51 degrees and sunny in the Huber Valley with a high of 82. With details about today's weather outlook is ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
Happy Monday, KPCW listeners. It is Monday, Memorial Day, and time for a look at your forecast for the Wasatch Back. We're going to be looking at a mixture of sun and clouds as we go throughout the day. Temperatures will climb into the upper 70s for us in Park City. We'll see those highs climbing into the low 80s in the Heber Valley. There's a little bit of moisture trying to sneak into the area. I don't expect much in the way of a big rain chance, but there is a slight chance that we see a high-based thunderstorm or two popping up in the highest of elevations. That'll primarily bring some gusty winds. Maybe a little lightning, but not a lot of rainfall. So overall, mainly dry, just a very slim chance of a pop-up storm. As we go into your forecast for your Tuesday, we're going to be tracking a cutoff low pressure that's going to move a little closer to us, but it's not going to have a ton of moisture. Again, we can't rule out an isolated shower or storm popping up, but the bigger story will be the mixture of sun and clouds and temperatures that will be in the low 70s in Park City, upper 70s in the Heber Valley. But the big thing you're going to notice, the winds will be on the increase. We'll be looking at some of those gusty southwesterly winds anywhere from up to 30 to 50 miles per hour as you go throughout your Tuesday. That will only increase to more likely 40 to 50 mile per hour wind gusts as we go into your Wednesday with mostly sunny to partly cloudy skies. Again, not a ton of rain chances with that, but definitely some wind coming in with highs only in the low 70s in Park City on your Wednesday. Highs will be in the upper 70s to near 80 in the Heber Valley. Now, with that low pressure in the area, we'll keep that mostly sunny to partly sunny sky around for your Thursday. Highs remaining in the low 70s in Park City, upper 70s in the Heber Valley. But as we get on the backside of that low pressure, we could see a little bit of a cooling trend. So highs may only be in the low to mid 60s in Park City for the end of the work week, heading into the weekend with overnight lows dipping back down into the 30s. And in the Heber Valley, highs in the upper 60s to 70s with overnight lows dipping back into the 30s. Again, that would be for the end of the week, heading into the weekend. But for now, let's enjoy a very warm start to the unofficial start of summer. That's a look at your forecast. I'm ABC4 meteorologist Cedric Haynes.
It is 8:08. I'm KBCW's Grace Dorfler. I am filling in for Leslie Thatcher this morning on the local news hour. Taking a quick look at the traffic as well, things look relatively clear across the region as we begin this holiday. It looks like there may be some minor slowdowns on northbound US 40 around the Sky Ridge and East Village area. But other than that, I'm not seeing any major problems traffic-wise to report. I'll let you know if that changes over the course of the next hour. Well, coming up on today's show, we have a full show ahead for you. First, we are going to be hearing from Liberty Sanctuary. KPCW's Connor Thomas sat down to learn more about the work that they do with horses here in the Wasatch Back. After that, we'll be hearing from the Wasatch Trails Foundation. Their representative shares more about the Wild Trail Grid opening this summer and a new pump track in Heber City. And finally, we will be hearing from the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation with reminders about life jacket and boat safety as we head into peak boat season here in the Wasatch Back. After that, at 9 o'clock on Mountain Money, Roger and Kevin will speak with author Matt Algio about his book, The Secret Subway. It is the fascinating story of Alfred Beach, the man who successfully built a pneumatic subway beneath Broadway in the mid-19th century. Then they will speak with Gabriel Sherman, author of Bonfire of the Murdochs. It's the real-life story of the family drama over who would succeed Rupert Murdoch to control his vast media empire. That's all coming up at 9 o'clock on Mountain Money. We will be back with some more local news right after this. It is coming up on 8:11. You are listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. The Park City Council and Mayor's salaries will more than double in fiscal year 2027. KPCW's Christine Weller reports the Council approved the pay bumps after a public hearing.
The Park City Council gave itself and the Mayor a substantial raise at its Thursday meeting in a 4-to-1 vote. Salaries will more than double in fiscal year 2027, with councilor pay rising from nearly $29,000 to more than $58,000. The mayor's salary will increase from more than $55,000 to almost $117,000. The elected officials also receive health benefits, and the mayor has a car allowance. A handful of locals shared their concerns at a public hearing. 40-year resident Peter Marth said city staff and emergency personnel should get pay increases instead.
Raising your own salary seems to be a self-serving act in the current environment of uncertainty while also obliterating the true value of our community's civic duty style of management at exactly the wrong moment in time.
Local Michael Kaplan said he understands the positions are demanding. However, he said it's bad form to double salaries so soon after an election year. Former Mayor Nan Worrell spoke in support of the pay increases. She said she's discussed the topic with many residents over the past few weeks, and many leave the conversation surprised at the work required of a councillor or mayor.
Their comment always is, wow, I thought it was just a part-time job. Or somehow they imply that because it's a public service position, that it doesn't deserve to be fairly compensated for the time or the expertise that the position requires.
Worrell said the augmented pay will also open the job to more people, as a person's economic situation won't be as big of a consideration. Council member Molly Miller echoed the sentiment.
The low pay limits who can serve. Historically, the wealthy, retired, or extremely energetic could afford to hold these seats. When our community's decision makers do not experience the daily financial pressures of workforce working residents, crucial perspective is lost.
She said she stepped away from a six-figure salary to take on the role. Councilmember Tana Tolley said she is in a unique position because her family has lived in Old Town for generations. She runs a family restaurant on Main Street and said she's lucky to have a job flexible enough to be on the council. But that's not the full story.
I actually lose money being on council. I had to hire a manager at the restaurant to take my place so that I could do this. And I understand that. And I understood that when I signed up for it. But it was a huge decision for me to make.
Outside of cost of living adjustments, the council and mayor haven't had pay increases since fiscal year 2015. When making the recommendation, city staff also looked at other governments, including Summit County. Summit County councilors got a pay bump in December 2025, raising salaries from $61,000 to $70,000 per year. Councilmember Bill Sirocco was the only no vote.
I don't think we should be benchmarking against other places. We should look at sort of the role here and what we want the role to mean to people. It's not employment. It's not meant to support your lifestyle. This is public service.
The council approved the raises through an ordinance establishing elected officials' compensation. They will be finalized when the city officially adopts a fiscal year 2027 budget on June 11th. Christine Weller, KPCW News.
Wasatch Back Health officials say ticks could be more of an issue this season after a record warm winter. KPCW's Sydney Weaver reports.
The Wasatch County Health Department expects to see more ticks and tick-borne diseases this year after a mild winter. Health Officer Jonelle Fitzgerald expects them to emerge earlier as well.
But we did have a mild winter where they could have wintered over better and easier. We generally see ticks from snow melt, which we know that there wasn't much of that.
Ticks live in areas with tall grasses, sagebrush, leaves, and wood, and are most common in the early summer months before it gets too hot. Fitzgerald says it's critical to check for ticks after hiking, biking, and recreating outdoors.
They like to be in areas that are kind of hidden, a belly button, the back of your knees, maybe around the waists or under your arms. And in and around the hair and ears.
To avoid ticks, health officials suggest EPA-approved insect repellent along with closed-toed shoes, tall socks, long sleeves, and pants. Bright clothing also makes it easier to spot ticks and quickly remove them. Fitzgerald says ticks can be removed from the skin with tweezers and afterward clean the wound with soap and water, then watch for tick-borne illnesses like Lyme disease and Rocky Mountain spotted fever.
It's unlikely, it's rare, but it does happen, and so it's just something to be aware of.
Fitzgerald says to visit a doctor if a rash appears after a tick bite. More information on ticks and how to prevent disease is available at kpcw.org. Sydney Weaver, KPCW News.
Keller Williams and the Keels. Keller built his reputation initially on his engaging live performances, no two of which are ever alike. Joining him on stage is award-winning flat picker Larry Keel and his rock-solid, in-the-pocket bass-playing wife, Jenny Keel. on the Egyptian Theater stage May 28th through the 30th. For more information, you can go online to parkcityshows.com or call the box office at 855-745-SHOW. The Egyptian Theater is a nonprofit organization and a KPCW supporter.
It's 8:16. You're listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler. KPCW's Connor Thomas sat down with Deborah West, the executive director and founder of Heber's Liberty Sanctuary, an equine rescue facility. They discussed how Liberty saves horses from slaughter and fosters meaningful human-equine bonds. A recent film screening highlighted the mental health benefits of those bonds, too. Here's Connor's conversation with Deborah.
We're here with Deborah West. She runs the Liberty Sanctuary in Heber. Deborah, thank you so much for being with us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
So it's a horse sanctuary and rescue operation that you run. Can you kind of introduce your facility to folks who are unaware of it and sort of say where you are and what you do?
Absolutely. So we're based in East Heber, and we rescue horses from the slaughter pipeline. So the horses that are on property that have been rescued, we have about 25 on property now, because we also work to train them and adopt them out. And we've adopted out 7 this year, actually, since January, which is really exciting. The horses are doing really well. But all of our rescues come from the slaughter pipeline, like I mentioned, and usually from Texas or Colorado. And then we also advocate for them and support legislation that's in Congress right now, particularly the SAFE Act, which would forever ban the export of American horses for slaughter.
I understand you are also responsible for bringing a film to Park City's Jim Santee Auditorium on Thursday. What was that?
So the film is called Rescued Hearts, and I've worked for about a year or so with the filmmakers to try to bring it to the local area. And the Park City Library was really fantastic at working with us to be able to show the film in a really professional way. The film is really about the horse-human connection, and it could be as simple as building your own connection with a horse, but we also invited equine facilitators, so groups like the Equelness Center also in Park City, the Equine Empowerment Center in Sandy, and Horses for Mental Health, also based here in Utah. This is Mental Health Awareness Month, so it meant a lot to us to be able to showcase the film and this work in May. And we're also doing some coaching here, equine-assisted coaching on property at Liberty Sanctuary with our life coach, Bela, who is here on property all the time. Yeah, so it was really meaningful to be able to share that with people and share the fact that horses contribute so much to our communities.
The documentary is called Rescued Hearts, for those who missed it. Is it more about sort of the mental wellness benefits of the equine-human connection? Does it have anything to say about the slaughter pipeline that you mentioned?
The film is primarily about that horse-human connection, but there are other rescues featured in the film who are using horses in their kind of therapies or equine-assisted services. And that's very similar to what we do here on property. So we are using horses that have been rescued for this coaching work, and some horses that haven't. It sort of just depends on what the fit is for that group or that individual that day. But with 25 plus horses on property, we have a good amount to be able to select from. And we see a horse kind of going in that direction and showing curiosity for humans in that way will enhance training along those lines so that the horse is more suitable for that kind of work.
Can you say more about what the pipeline looks like? I'm not very familiar with why horses get slaughtered, given that they're not a main food source.
Right, they're not. It's actually really tragic. And when I found out about it, it's what made me launch Liberty Sanctuary, basically to try to help bring awareness to this issue, because I think a lot of Utahns and that are horsemen really don't realize this. But last year, 25,000 American horses were sent to slaughter in Mexico and Canada. And that number has gone up a little bit in the last year, but that number used to even be much, much higher. And we don't believe that any American horse should be sent to slaughter. They're sent out of the country because in 2007, the American slaughterhouses were essentially closed down. And so the kill buyers found a loophole to send those horses out of the United States for even a worse fate than they had in the U.S. And they were shut down in the U.S. because it was found to be incredibly inhumane here. And we can only imagine outside of the country, there are no controls and there's no, protection for the horses. And slaughter in general is just not humane whatsoever. So, we are proponents of doing ethical euthanasia, things like that, when horses, need to if they're, very ill or older and they need to find an end. We are in favor of other things. We understand horses, animals, dogs, cats. We get to that point in our lives. We don't slaughter our dogs and cats. It's just not humane, and it's not what we feel is even American. American horse is the reason we're in Utah. So if without the horse, we wouldn't have the freedoms here that we have now. And it's our job to stand up for them and not to continue to allow them to be sold out. So there actually was a really good piece of news late last night, early this morning. So in Congress, in the House, Transportation Committee has just adopted a language very similar to the anti-slaughter language that's in the SAFE Act, and it's going to go to the Senate now. And so we really suggest that everybody contact our senators to let them know that we don't support slaughter of American horses. And you ask why they're sent to slaughter. Over 92% of horses that are in the slaughter pipeline are young and healthy. And that was the really eye-opening thing to me. And that's why the horses that we bring to Utah to rescue are, they mimic the population in the slaughter pipeline, because it's not the old horses. Yes, there are some, of course, but the majority of horses, according to the USDA, are young and healthy. And those horses are just simply lacking in education. They've been abandoned or even worse, mistreated by humans in the past. And it's up to us as humans to make things right. So that's what we do here at Liberty Sanctuary. And, honestly, for the longest time, people have asked us to do coaching and this kind of work that's featured in the film. But initially, and first and foremost, our primary patients are truly our horses. And so we needed to have them here longer, first to relax. And then, as they're, showing curiosity, we put them into different types of training, depending on how the horse presents. And now there are some that we are working with in this kind of coaching, like I mentioned.
Yeah, horses are a far cry from goldfish in terms of love, care, and attention that they need. So if I'm understanding it correctly, a lot of the horses that you're saying are sent to slaughter are simply unable to be cared for by their former owners, and then kind of it's a way of like letting your dog run stray because you can't take care of it anymore?
It really is. And honestly, especially when you decide to become the owner or parent, let's say, of such a majestic animal. I mean, it really requires a lot of responsibility. And we really believe that as horsemen, it's upon all of us to show that type of responsibility for equines in general. I had a few horses and I felt responsible for all the other horses that weren't being treated as well. And I think as Americans who care about justice, we should care about that as well. So I don't think you have to be a horseman to appreciate this issue and to realize that this is truly unfair and that there's a lot more we can do about it.
What kind of response did you get at the film screening? Because there was a panel discussion afterward, and you told me before you went on air that hundreds of people attended. What were you hearing?
It was so great. It was really such a proud moment to be in the theater with my colleagues and just to hear, people's emotions. You could hear people with tears. You could hear people laughing. The film is really well balanced. And what we also really appreciate about the film, and partly why I wanted to bring it to Park City, is that they really do a great job of balancing the science with the magic of working with horses. And we think that balance is extremely important.
Do you know where folks can watch the film if they weren't able to attend on Thursday?
I've heard from the filmmakers, Dana and Krisana, that this summer they're going to have a window where you can stream the film on their website and pay for a ticket. And so I would suggest that people go to rescuedheartsfilm.com and sign up for updates. They don't blast you. It's not too much, but then you'll be in the loop for when they do release that this summer.
We talked about the care that horses require, but it's obviously very fulfilling and people do love and bond with these animals. And you said you have 25, an adoption event coming up on June 6th. Can you say more about that?
Yeah. It was terrible. We didn't have very much snow for skiers this winter, but honestly, we were able to make a lot of really great progress with our horses. And so our first adoption event of the summer is June 6th. There's a number of really beautiful and younger horses. Our oldest horse on property is about 12 right now. Most of the horses are far younger than that. A good percentage of the ones we'll have up for adoption are rideable at this time. We really invite the community to come out between 11 and 3 on Saturday, June 6th. We also do offer two other public events in the week. Saturdays from 1 to 3, we have kind of mini clinics for any horsemen or non-horsemen who are interested in learning about horses. And also on Wednesdays from 6 to 8 p.m., we do something we call Picnic with the Ponies, and you're welcome to bring your friends and a sandwich and a beer if you want, and come watch Sierra, our trainer, work with the rescued horses and getting them ready for June 6th and the rest of their lives, really.
Potential adoptive families, is there any paperwork they need to bring? Anything special that's, you know, specifically because you're adopting a horse?
Yeah, we're really careful about where the horses go. So these are good questions. Adoption contract is on our site, but I'm also happy to send it to anyone. We ask to visit or see good video of the facility where you'd be keeping the horse. But we're really looking to create like a perfect match. So the chemistry with the horse is really important, and the person's level of horsemanship, or whether they're going to hire a trainer or our trainer. Our very first horse is going to Promontory this summer to live, and so we're very excited about that. We look to really make a beautiful connection and one that will last. And we also, in the contract, it states we do co-own the horse for the first year of its adoption. And that's partly, you know, just a way to keep that horse out of the slaughter pipeline and be able to keep good tabs on the horse.
Deborah West of Liberty Sanctuary, thank you so much for speaking with us today. Is there anything else you'd like to mention before we go?
Visit us either in person or online at libertysanctuary.org. And we're also at Liberty Sanctuary on Facebook and Instagram. But we really appreciate this opportunity to chat with you.
Deborah, thank you again.
Thanks.
That was Connor Thomas speaking with Deborah West of Liberty Sanctuaries. You're listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. We'll be right back after this. It is 8:30. You are listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler. Well, on the phone with us is Wasatch Trails Foundation Board Treasurer Mike Rosberg. Mike, good morning. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you. Thanks so much for calling in. I'm glad you could join us.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Well, it sounds like it's going to be quite a busy summer for the Wasatch Trails Foundation, and I know our listeners are looking forward to hearing some updates. Let's start with the pump track grand opening. First of all, it sounds like you guys have a pretty big celebration planned for this new addition to outdoor recreation in Wasatch County. Could you tell me a little bit about what's going on this week?
Yeah, so we're excited. We have our grand opening this Friday on the 29th. And yeah, we're going to have food trucks, live music. We've got a bike giveaway. It's a kind of a dirt jumper specific for the pump track we have. And we're just super excited to bring this project to its end and turn it over to the community.
Very exciting. Where is the pump track?
So the pump track is it's at the Southfield Park. It's where we have the rodeo grounds. We've got pickleball courts, and it's right across the street from the new Deer Creek High School.
Okay, yeah, and a very popular park in Heber City. So I anticipate it'll be heavily trafficked.
It's just kind of like right in the middle of all that.
Yeah. I'm not much of a biker myself. Could you share a little bit, maybe for other listeners who are in the same boat as me, like what exactly is a pump track and who can use it?
So a pump track, this particular pump track is an asphalt pump track. And it looks similar to a kind of like a skateboard skate park, but it's built for bikes, and it's just got all these up and down kind of jumps and berms that kind of just all flow together, and it's all paved. So kids from little Strider bikes to like parents on mountain bikes are going to have fun on this track.
Very nice. Are you a biker yourself? Are you planning to get out there?
Yes, I have a garage full of bikes, but I don't have a jumping dirt bike bike. So I might be needing to add one to my collection. So
makes sense. Yeah, I think this occasion calls for it. Yeah. How long has this project been in the works, Mike?
This has been in the works for about 3 years. We've had a lot of great partners. This is a Wasatch County park. And so they've been great to work with. We've had Wasatch Community Foundation has been a big sponsor. We've used funds from the new TAP tax. That's the Trails, Arts, and Parks sales tax that was passed about 5 years ago. All the cities, Heber City, Midway City, and Wasatch County have all been supporting this project.
Very nice. A lot of community support. Do you know the total cost of the project?
I was not prepared for that one, you'll have to check back with me on that one. I'm sorry about that.
That's okay. Thank you anyhow. So we're looking forward to that. In addition, it sounds like the WOW is getting some expansions this summer. That's the Wasatch Over Wasatch Trail. I understand that this is kind of special because the WOW's sort of what connects Summit and Wasatch counties. Do I have that right?
That is correct, yeah. So the Wasatch or the WOW Trail, as we call it, that's been kind of our signature trail in Heber I don't even know when that was started. It was probably 15, 20 years ago. What we've been able to do this last year is we're connecting the WOW Trail to Bonanza Flat, so you can ride from Park City to Heber all on dirt, and it's a fantastic trail.
Mm-hmm. So what's new this summer?
So this summer, which will be opening up the first week in June, because the Bonanza Flat area has a wildlife closure until the first week in June. But from Bonanza, there's a new trail called Wowza, and it heads south from the southern edge of the Bonanza Flat area and connects onto the top section of the WOW Trail. In addition to this connection, the last half of this connection, it has its own little loop, and the downhill loop has all kinds of natural berms, built wood kind of ladder jumps and berms that you can take through, and then we have a little uphill trail, so you can kind of do parts of this trail by itself, or it can be part of a huge connection for a big ride.
Wow. Okay. That sounds pretty epic. Which part of it are you most looking forward to?
Well, I was able to, do some pre-rides last fall. And what I like is starting at the top of the WOW trailhead, bike up the Pine Canyon Road to Bonanza Flat, hook on the last part of the Bonanza Flat, hook on to Wowza. Wowza is 5 miles from the Bonanza Flat Trail to the WOW Trail, and then you've got 2 miles of the upper WOW Trail back to the trailhead. Mm-hmm. So you've got a really nice upper loop that you can do without shuttling cars or, having a huge ride in front of you.
Yeah, it sounds like maybe a nice way to get to know the area, too, maybe for visitors or something like that.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. As we're heading into the busy season on the trails, I know trail maintenance is a big part of what the Wasatch Trails Foundation does. And I'm wondering if you could share any reminders of how people can be good stewards of the trails as they're getting out there this summer.
First of all, I mean, I wish we would have the problem of having wet and muddy trails that we would need to stay off of. But, usually our summers are fairly dry. But in our trails in the Wasatch State Park area, we have little self-service trail easels, meaning like if you're riding along and you'll see like a shovel and a rake and some loppers out in the middle of nowhere. And we kind of move these along the trail and people are able to kind of trim and help back to the trail system that way. The other way is just, don't litter, stay on the trails and enjoy.
Sounds good. I understand e-bikes are allowed on some trails in Wasatch County, or at least certain kinds of e-bikes, and that's somewhat different from Summit County. So would you be able to share an overview of what's allowed on Wasatch County trails as far as e-bikes go?
So class one e-bikes are allowed on really on all of our mountain bike that we call non-motorized trails. So that would be the Jordanelle Ridge system, the Wasatch State Park, kind of our Blue Sage and Big Pole. And just a reminder that a class one e-bike is a pedal assist bike that doesn't have any assist over 20 miles an hour. Mm-hmm.
And no throttle or anything like that?
That's right. So if it has a throttle, it's not a class one. And if it assists over more than 20 miles an hour, it's not a class one.
Gotcha. And do the same rules apply? Like, I guess, should e-bikes always yield to hikers and maybe acoustic bikers as well?
Yeah. They're just the same in that, that little courtesy triangle that you see at the trailheads that, bikes pretty much should yield to everybody, horses and hikers.
Good to know. Well, we've talked a little bit about the Wasatch Mountain State Park side of things, a little bit about Sky Ridge. In a different section of the county, kind of in the Soldier Hollow area, you mentioned that there's a Heber Halo project happening. Could you share a little bit about what that is?
Yeah, so our board kind of came up with this vision. It was early last year. And the Heber Halo is we have a vision of connecting the whole Heber Valley with one interconnecting trail that goes around the whole valley, hence the halo idea. Our first leg of this is having a trail that goes from the Wasatch State Park, the golf course in the Snake Creek area. And it goes along the west side of the valley at about 8,000 feet, and we'll join into the Soldier Hollow Deer Creek Trail.
Wow. So, and what's the timeline on that? It sounds like it's kind of in very preliminary stages right now.
So this section, this section is all on Utah state land. So the land portion of this is going to be easier than some of the other sections, but we already have a grant and feasibility and engineering studies going on this summer. So our plan is to have the route finalized and flagged by the fall, and then we'll be applying for grants to start building in 27.
Wow, that's quite exciting.
Yeah, we're super excited for this.
Good to hear. Well, it sounds like things are very busy at the Wasatch Trails Foundation right now. We're in our last minute or two here, but are there any other projects or any other reminders you want to share with our listeners before I let you go?
The only last thing is we have a new little section of trail that's just was finished this month over on the Jordan L Ridge Trail System. It's the northernmost section that overlooks the Jordan L Dam. It's called the JR Memorial Trail. Mm-hmm. If you're on Trail Forks, you can kind of see this. It's probably about 3 to 4 miles. Beautiful views, and we just had our Wasatch High School mountain bike team. We had 50 of them out Saturday, finishing the smoothing all the corners, cutting all the little roots off of it. So it's all buffed out and riding really nice right now.
Awesome. Well, lots to look forward to in Wasatch County this summer on the trails. We've been speaking with Wasatch Trails Foundation board member Mike Rosberg. Mike, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, and everybody have a good holiday, and we'll see you on the trails.
Awesome. That was Mike Rosberg with some trail updates. You're listening to KPCW, and we'll be right back after this. It's 8:45. You are listening to the Local News Hour from KPCW. I'm Grace Dorfler, filling in for Leslie Thatcher. KPCW's Christine Weller recently sat down with Ty Hunter, the boating program manager from the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation, to discuss life jacket safety. Here is that conversation.
Good morning. I'm KPCW's Christine Weller, and joining me today is Ty Hunter, the boating program manager for the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation. He's here to talk a little bit about boating and life jacket safety. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you for having me on the show today.
Yes, thanks for joining us. So I first wanted to talk a little bit about the Life Jacket Loaner Station program. Utah expanded that this week, but can you talk a little bit about why that program was first started?
It was first started through a grant program, a national grant program. There are two of them that are out there. It's the Boat US Foundation and then Towboat US. We're running that grant. And the state of Utah started that. Oh, let's see. That would have been early 2000s when we started dipping into that grant. And then as things have kind of gone along, we've done some expansions with, you know, furthering the grant and such. And then this year, because of really a lot of the unfortunate circumstances that have happened last year and the year before, years before with that, we're like, we need to expand this. See what we can try to do to bridge that gap of people maybe not, you know, if they've forgotten or they there's a barrier in purchasing the jackets, that they can come up and in essence check out a life jacket, use it, and then return it when they're all done, and it's free of charge.
Tell us a little bit more about this recent expansion. I know it was unveiled in Jordan L State Park. So how many stations are there total in Utah? And how, I mean, you mentioned a little bit about how it works, but do you have to sign in to check out a life jacket? How exactly does that work?
In some places, you're gonna have to sign in. Some places you will not have to with that. In essence, the sign in piece is we're just trying to get the jackets back. We don't mind them walking away as long as they're going to be put to good use with that. But there's a lot of times we'll fill up these loaner life jacket trees, and by the end of the first weekend, they're empty, which just kind of makes it hard to keep them in service. So that's why the checkout process kind of came in with that. As to your first question with that is how many do we have statewide? I'm going to tell you, I don't know the number yet right now, because we're consistently growing with that at that point in time. The majority of water-based state parks are going to have life jacket loaner stations at them. And that's starting with a huge donation that we've had from our medical professionals that we've teamed up with. And also the Division of State Parks has made a large purchase, and also the Division of Outdoor Recreation has made a large purchase. So we are going to have a stockpile of these jackets to where we can implement and open up new ones, but we can also go through and update old ones that may need some updating on some of those jackets.
Okay. You mentioned that the loaner station program was kind of started due to a lot of unfortunate accidents in the state. Can you talk more about, you know, what are those risk factors? Because some of the people who have tragically died from drowning, they know how to swim. So what's happening here?
The big one is, and that's probably one of the most common lines in a statement as we're doing an investigation after an incident, like a drowning incident. And it is said, they're such a good swimmer. And to kind of come into this and explain, open water is a lot different than a pool. There's no lifeguards, and the temperatures are different. And I mean, I know there are some cold pools out there, but you kind of pop yourself out and you can warm yourself up and do that. If you decide to go for a swim and you swim like, oh, okay, I'm going to go swim 100 yards out, maybe to a buoy, and then come back, that's going to be a lot longer swim than what you would normally deal with in a pool, because usually you have lines, you have some point of reference to go to, so you're going to be swimming a lot longer than 100 yards getting back with that. Plus you have a little bit of wave action, which you're not going to have a whole lot of that in a pool. There might be slight currents, nothing like we would experience on our coastal areas with the currents and the tides and stuff there like that. We don't have that here unless you're more kind of around a stream or in a stream. The other one is that the bottom is not uniform. You might be able to touch in one spot and then you're not touching in another. And so that's a little bit different than that uniformity of a pool, that it consistently either gets deeper as it goes out and it keeps that straight line in there as we go. And there's quite a bit in there. And then temperature. I talked about temperature, but water, in essence, if it's, you know, lower than your body temp, and Utah, in essence, is a cold water state. We kind of say that if it's the majority of the state's less than 70 degrees, it's a cold water state. And on the most part, our waters are 70 and below with that. So we consider it a cold water state. And you start thinking of that, that's 30 degrees less than your body temperature. So that water is giving you a big old hug, and it's robbing every piece of heat away from you faster than your body can actually replenish that heat to maintain its own core temperature. And so that's where you start having all of these items put all together. That's why that such a good swimmer is not such a good swimmer anymore with it. I mean, it takes a lot of training, and it takes a lot of precautions when you start to do open water swimming.
Yeah, and I know that as, you know, kind of to prevent those deaths, Utah does require life jackets. Can you talk a bit more about that and why it's still important for the state to have these loaner stations?
So life jackets are required to be on every vessel, and we need one for every person that's on the vessel. And then the required wearing is for those that are under 13 years of age, so 12 years and younger, and those that are involved in toad sports, then they'll have to be wearing it as they're doing the toad sports activity behind their boat. There is one body of water in the state of Utah that is a mandatory wearer body of water for all activities. If you touch that water, you've got to have a life jacket on, and that's Causey Reservoir. The Weber County created an ordinance, and it has been a long-standing ordinance, and it was there because Causey is just a whole different animal. It is a very cold water lake, and it is one that is awfully hard for search and rescue to do recoveries out of. It is very dangerous for divers, and so, you know, we try to utilize other pieces of equipment like ROVs, to recover these individuals. But this is Causey's one that if it takes somebody's life, it's a high likelihood that they may not be recovered with it. And so that's why Causey is the way that it is. So to go back, I mean, I'm going to say I would love to have a requirement that every lake, everybody has to wear a life jacket. I think that we would see a lot less tragedy and items there. Now, there's going to be people that will argue until they're blue in the face with me on that aspect, because that's either, you know, large overreach or whatever else with that. But that's just the things. Life jackets save lives. They are proven to save lives. Can you die with a life jacket on? Yes, you can. Mm-hmm. But it's going to be overexposure piece there. So it's not going to be an immediate thing that you're all of a sudden going to die with a life jacket on, unless it's a traumatic, something trauma-wise wrong with you and your body. It's going to be that time period of exposure and hypothermia will be a victim of hypothermia and potentially drowned when you become unconscious with a life jacket. So that's the thing, is I also have used the line, life jackets buy you time. So they buy you time in order to be rescued or in order to try to get yourself to a place of safety.
Yeah, and as far as boating as well, there are some requirements for that as well. If someone is using a watercraft in Utah, can you give us an overview of what those requirements are?
Are you talking like education courses?
Yes.
So an education course. So currently right now, the only required education course that we have for boat operators is for our personal watercraft operators that are under 18 years of age, but greater than 12 years and older. So it's 12 to 17 years of age, they have to take that boating course if they're going to operate a personal watercraft. Really, it has made a tremendous difference what has occurred out there, because I can remember starting my career before that education course was in place, and then now I'm sunsetting my career and seeing that our personal watercraft crashes and accidents are not as high as they used to be. With that, now I am going to say behavior, there are still some behaviors that we need to have changed with that, and I think with all boaters we need to see behavioral change there, and that is going to lead in that more news to come. But there was a law passed last year that is going to require a mandatory boating education combined in with aquatic invasive species education together, and it'll be for all operators that'll be operating a motorboat that is required to do that muscle aware test. So if that particular craft is required to take the aquatic invasive species muscle aware test, they're going to have to take this test also. If they're required to do that, they're going to have to take that test. This will be a 20-minute test. It'll be free. It is going to be annual, but there's an opportunity for an individual to just take the test. If they pass, they're out in less than 20 minutes. If they don't pass, then they got a 20-minute course they need to go through, and then they'll pass at that time at the end of that 20-minute course, and then they can buy their AIS decal and get their certificate, and everything should be all good. We're going to run some educational pieces out with this as this comes along, as we get a little bit later in our year with that. I know we're going to see some opposition, but with change, there's always opposition. Really, this is a good thing. We're going to focus on life jackets, getting more information out about them. We're going to talk about potential rescue procedures that can save lives. We're also going to talk about driving under the influence, and that it is the same on the road as it is on the water, and the water onto the road. The same penalties and everything that are there. We want our waterways to be safe. And then we're going to also talk about some navigational items that they need to know about, especially what we call speed and proximity. And this one is a big one, where we got to keep 100 boats while they're above a wakeless speed, need to stay 150 feet away from other boats, from persons in the water, swimmers that are in the water, boat ramps, boat docks, and swim beach areas, and also shoreline fishermen. What that's going to do, if our boaters will adhere to that law, that's going to reduce the amount of user conflicts, and also in reducing those user conflicts reports coming in, there could potentially keep it to where we can keep our waterways more multiple use instead of having to start looking into segregation of uses. And that, frankly, is not going to make everybody happy at all. Mm-hmm. You know, so that there's going to be even more anger there with that. So big thing, go out and have fun. Keep your distance away from people. Wear your life jackets and take a boating education course. That's really the simple things that folks will need to do.
Great. I think that sums it up perfectly. And that's all we've got time for. So thank you so much for joining us. We've been speaking with Ty Hunter, the boating program manager from the Utah Division of Outdoor Recreation. You're listening to the Local News Hour.
As gas prices climb while conflict continues in the Middle East, Utahns feeling the pinch are changing Memorial Day plans this year. KUER's Hugo Ricard Bell spoke with a few.
Small business owner Kerry Simon didn't know quite how to introduce himself when we reached out.
I'm just a regular guy. I guess I'm a road tripper. I'm a car guy. I don't know.
One thing is clear though. Traveling is in his blood.
I mean, we are a road tripping family. My wife and I did the van life thing before we had our daughters.
But after this year's meteoric rise of fuel prices, he's not hitting the road.
As far as this Memorial Day, we're going to buy a grill and we're going to stay home.
Others like him told KUER that they are also planning to stay put this year, the backyard barbecue winning out over a road trip. Statewide, the average price for a gallon of regular gas is $4.70. For Simon, he also feels uneasy about the underlying role oil and gas plays in war.
There is a true human cost to it. This is like weird juxtaposition that we're celebrating Memorial Day, and we do that by putting gas into our car and driving somewhere with our families.
Right now, Iran is reviewing the latest ceasefire proposal from the White House. Hugo Ricard Bell, KUER News.